Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Crystal Hill is back on the job as CMS superintendent after a two-month investigation, the details of which remain secret. Still, school board chair Stephanie Sneed insists Hill and the board can work together.
We have every confidence that we will be able to do that.
The North Carolina GOP expresses confidence and excitement over their choice of Jennifer Balcom to replace Chuck Edwards as the congressional candidate in the 11th district.
We can't wait to get to work to get her elected.
In South Carolina, Lindsey Graham's sister Darlene will now run against Ralph Norman in a runoff in Republican efforts to find a Senate candidate. City Council is concerned about CMPD seeking a Make America Safe Again grant for fear of strings being attached. And the Matthews Town Attorney urges other municipalities to join them in their opposition to the state pushing them around over the I-77 toll lanes.
This style of legislation should have no place in our state or our country.
Here to fill us in on those stories and more is James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being here. Good morning.
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 After a two-month suspension with pay, CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill returned to work on Wednesday, yet we still know very little, James, about why she was suspended or about what the investigation that was conducted turned up. What do we know now? That was Wednesday. What do we know today?
Yeah, we arguably might have even more questions now than we did when this all started 2 months ago. If you'll recall, at the beginning of this, they said they were looking into matters involving administrative and operational oversight. On Tuesday night, Board Chair Stephanie Sneed made the announcement that they were reinstating her after this two-month investigation. They said that they had found some issues that will require ongoing attention as it relates to leadership and operational practice, and that they would address those directly with Dr. Hill. But citing personnel issues, they said they couldn't really disclose more than that or give more specific details. So we still don't know what prompted this whole thing or what these issues they identified might have been.
Do we know if the school board vote to bring her back at this stage was unanimous or not?
Yeah, that's another question that we still don't have an answer to. The board met in closed session for about 4 hours prior to Tuesday's meeting. They came out and gave this announcement. So presumably whatever discussion consensus they reached happened during this closed session, whether they took like a formal vote, you know, it was kind of unclear. Sneed was really pressed on this by reporters, you know, trying to get a sense of who voted for what the consensus was. And she declined to answer questions. When asked specifically if the vote was unanimous, she declined to answer. She said, regardless of whether it was unanimous, the board was planning on standing together moving forward. So it's unclear.
So as you said, on Tuesday evening, Stephanie Sneed issued a statement in which she said the independent investigation had been thorough and, quote, identified issues that will require ongoing attention as it relates to leadership and operational practice, and we will address those directly with Hill. When you were on this program on Wednesday morning to talk about this, that's all you knew. You know no more this morning, correct?
Not much more other than I did confirm with CMS that Hill is back at work. We have asked for a statement, have not gotten one yet. I've reached out to Dr. Hill directly, have not heard back yet. So waiting to see if she'll comment on anything prior to the start of the school year. But other than that, nothing new.
Ben.
You know, this puts CMS and the board in a tough situation, because I know we spoke to parents this past week who were really frustrated that we were going in 2 weeks before start of school, and they didn't know anything more about this investigation at the beginning of the week, and by the end of the week, as James alluded to, we don't know anything more now. I think the difficult position comes from the fact that if the board, in fact, really found nothing of real merit in order to suspend her further or get rid of her, then is it fair to release that information if they didn't find anything? Is it fair to Dr. Hill to release information if, in fact, they didn't find anything that they thought they might or suspect they might see?
This also strikes me as highly awkward for Crystal Hill. I mean, she went back to work on Wednesday morning. Has anybody said anything about that first day back at school? And how do you go back to school after having been off with pay for 2 months during an investigation about which nobody knows anything, how do you face the people who report to you?
Yeah, Mike, I think that's going to be a big question, especially, you know, when you look at what they announced on Tuesday. They didn't even really clear her name or say that there was nothing that was found. They left kind of open the possibility that there was something there. And you have to wonder if that's going to create tensions, whether between staff and Hill or the board and Hill. I mean, that just kind of, to me, opens up even more questions about this whole thing.
Well, on Tuesday, Stephanie Sneed went on to say that the board believes that returning Dr. Hill to work provides the best pathway forward for CMS. And I guess that's because we've had so much turnover in that job in the last 15 years or so. She also said that despite everything that has happened in the last 2 months, the board still has a good working relationship with Crystal Hill.
We have every confidence that we will be able to do that. Otherwise, she would not have been able to return to work. So we believe that with some oversight discussions, that we'll be able to do what's best for the interest of children.
So Crystal Hill has been a shining star in that job since she took that job. They love her. Everybody seems to love her. In fact, last December, the board gave her an extension on her contract and a raise, which happened to go into effect while she was on paid suspension. But under the shroud of secrecy surrounding this investigation, is she crippled by the board in regaining the trust of parents, faculty, staff, even the students? I mean, can she operate effectively with this cloud hanging over her head?
I think it's going to be tough to do that. I also think that there's going to be some trust issues from the public and the board as well, because the board is the one that's not releasing that information at this point, and have kind of been the ones that prompted these questions by starting this investigation. So I think it's kind of a question that goes both ways, both, you know, questions about Dr. Hill and about what this investigation presumably found or didn't find, and also questions about why it was started in the first place. Obviously, I think this also goes back to April. We saw kind of trust erode between the board and Hill during the budget process, which was really tense. And I'm sure that also raises some credibility issues from the public as well.
Well, don't you think that that's because they knew what was coming?
It's possible, for sure. I know that there was also some tensions there about the communication between staff and the board. The board felt like they were asking a lot of questions about things that were in the budget. They were getting kind of convoluted answers that they couldn't make sense of. And I know that prompted a lot of that frustration as well. But certainly the timing would raise the idea that those two things were happening at the same time.
So as usual, we are told there are personnel issues involved in this, and that's why they can't be transparent about it, because state law forbids personnel issues being released. But when the board announced her suspension in June, they cited, quote, matters involving administrative and operational oversight. That does not sound like a personnel issue. Shouldn't we expect greater transparency? This is over operational facts and figures. I mean, we should know that. We're taxpayers.
I mean, certainly when you use something as broad as operational administrative oversight, it does raise the question that some part of this investigation could be public. The public does have a right to know part of it, because when you're talking about operations and administration, that's the management of the whole district. It seems to me, and I'm not an expert on these kinds of things, but it seems to me that there should be at least something in there that could be revealed to the public. But, you know, that personnel law is pretty tight and is used quite often to create these kinds of tensions where there are things that have a high public interest, but they can't be disclosed because of the concerns about this and the state law that protects it.
And at one point, the WSOC-TV and the Charlotte Observer reported that the investigation centered on contracts with some of Hill's former colleagues that total over about $1.7 million over 3 years. Another cloud. What do we know about that this morning?
Yeah, nothing new on that front. I would say, I mean, I think this is something that's come up from some of her critics in the past, too, concerned that she might be using too many consultants and contracts and things like that. So again, I mean, the fact that that's out there and has not yet been addressed by anyone officially raises those questions. It allows that to kind of linger and add to this cloud of what's going on.
Ben?
I mean, and you also have to have historical context in this, and you alluded to it, Mike, 15th superintendent, I mean, seventh superintendent, I think in 15 years. And you had Ernest Winston most recently, but before that, Clayton Wilcox, you had Keith Morrison, who was touted, I think, as like superintendent of the year before he came here. That was back, I think, 12, 15 years ago. And in those cases, you had a superintendent who left under questionable circumstances. Granted, it was a different board at the time. It was a complete different makeup of people, but the same sort of situation of where you probably have longstanding parents in this district who are like, wait a second, we've been down this road before. We have had superintendents leave. They average about two and a half years or something like that. And they left under mysterious circumstances. And we never found out what happened to them. Wait, why is this happening again?
Right. Eric.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mike. I was having technology problems.
Wake up.
The other thing is, Ben's talking about this, and James has reported on, you know, the not just the paid leave, but the expense of having people come in to help with investigations. Is what did they spend on all of this? If it didn't really turn up much, we don't know that yet. But if it didn't turn up much, that could be a lot of money spent for very little gain. And going back to Ben's point, we've seen that over and over again with past superintendents as they leave.
We know that she was under investigation for 2 months, and they spent at least $275 an hour on at least one investigator. So you do the math. There may have been more than one investigator. James, did you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Ben said, too. It also felt like with this past school year when they released the test results and there was so much celebration and so much unanimity with the board backing those results and calling them historic, it felt like the district was building momentum. And then to have this kind of happen, I think just adds to that sense of instability that a lot of parents have told us that they feel, the sense of kind of like, oh, not again. Here we go again. Here's another superintendent coming in. It just makes you question, like, well, what must have been the prompting factor of this?
And that leads me to another statement that they board issued, saying families can feel confident that CMS is ready for the new school year and that the people throughout this organization remain focused on serving your children every day. I asked you this on Wednesday when you were on this program, James, and so I'll ask it again this morning. Given all that's happened in this investigation and over the last 15 years, why should parents be confident about anything at CMS?
I think a lot of parents are asking that question now. I know I've spoken to parents over the course of this investigation who have had those questions even before these results were announced on Tuesday. I think that the fact that you have that superintendent churn that's become kind of the narrative here is definitely driving a lot of uncertainty for families at CMS.
Okay. Stay tuned. More to come. North Carolina's 11th District Congressman Republican Chuck Edwards ended his reelection campaign after allegations of inappropriate behavior with staffers came to light. And this week, the state GOP selected State Representative Jennifer Balcom to replace Edwards on the November ballot. Since she is in the western part of the state, Ben, tell our listeners a little bit about her. Who is she?
So she has served in the General Assembly in the State House for two terms, and she is privately away from politics, I believe, a mortgage loan officer. She lives in Hendersonville. And it seemed like by the time we went into this this past week, that the executive committee there in that congressional district had come to some sort of unanimity to behind her, because several other top candidates had sort of dropped out of the running, said they weren't really interested. So by the time it came for a vote, it seemed like she was really the go-to person.
So as at a Monday meeting at the Buncombe County Republican Party headquarters in Asheville, the executive committee chose her out of six candidates, and they did so on the very first ballot. Mary Guy chairs the 11th District GOP, and she sounds very excited about their choice.
She's just very experienced, very passionate. She knows the values of this country. She's eighth-generation farmer. She's got a tremendous amount of legislative experience and a track record that's hard to beat. So we're just really excited that she has stepped up, and we can't wait to get to work to get her elected.
So this is now an open race. There's no incumbent. We have a Democrat running against her who is remaining confident in his chances of success, and we'll talk about that and the South Carolina GOP runoff that will happen later this month between Darlene Graham and Ralph Norman. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. James Farrell's with us, our education reporter at WFAE News. Alexandria Sands is here. Quiet so far, but she'll be piping up shortly. She's with Axios Charlotte. Ben Thompson's an anchor at WCNC-TV. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. So this week, the 11th Congressional District GOP chose Jennifer Balcom to replace Chuck Edwards on the ticket, and she will run against Democrat Jamie Ager. Is that how you say his name, or is it Ager? Okay.
Ager.
Ager. Say it again.
I believe it's Ager.
Oh, okay.
Hard G. Yeah.
I have to learn it. So anyway, she will face Democrat, who was asked last week by WLOS-TV in Asheville how this change affects his campaign.
We've run the same campaign this whole time. We're focused on Helene recovery. We're focused on the fact that the cost of living is too high for so many people all over Western North Carolina. And we're focused on the fact that people are sick and tired of corruption and this stuff going on in Washington, D.C. that causes them to lose trust in our country. And that's just sad. And so no, strategy is the exact same. We're just locked in and ready to go win this thing.
This was already a closely watched race because control of the House hangs in the balance. How does this switch up with these two non-incumbents switch things up? Eric.
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, let me just go back to the weekend for a moment. Jennifer Baucom was not a candidate until Sunday because State Senator Tim Moffitt was considered to be the favorite. So I'm curious how that changed so quickly. But then looking ahead, as you say, we have two non-incumbents in this race, and Jamie Ager has quite the advantage, not only because he's been running longer, but because he has roughly $2 million in the bank. Chuck Edwards had less than $500,000. He has not said whether he will hand that off to Jennifer Baucom. And the other thing that comes into play here, Mike, is this is a really big district. I think it's 16 counties, something like that. So she's got a lot of territory to cover in a very short amount of time.
And in her state district, in the legislature, does a lot of it overlap those counties?
It's about 12%, I think, of the total area. So, again, that's a lot of ground to cover.
Okay. There's also a GOP primary, Senate primary in South Carolina this week, and they to choose a replacement for the late Senator Lindsey Graham. His sister, Darlene, who is serving out the remainder of his term, is also in this race, and she edged out Rock Hill's Ralph Norman for the lead in this race.
This is a very emotional night because I'm usually standing here celebrating with Lindsey. So I know he's looking down right now, smiling, though, so that gives me peace.
So she and Norman will head to a runoff later this month, Ben, in preparation for November. Norman is a known commodity. She is not, but she has the Graham last name, and she has the endorsement of Donald Trump. Is there a race to be had here?
Oh, I definitely think there's a race, and I think this one's actually super interesting. Not only do you have the drama of the sudden passing of Lindsey Graham, his sister going into place, but also you have a behind-the-scenes drama that the candidates don't want to talk about, but for every reason possible, on paper, Ralph Norman should have the support of Donald Trump, for every reason possible, with the exception of Ralph Norman made the cardinal mistake of endorsing Nikki Haley 2 years ago in the presidential race. And if it wasn't for that, I think you could very well believe that he would have the president's endorsement. Because keep in mind, I mean, Ralph Norman, I chatted with him yesterday. He's been running this entire summer. For one, he was running for governor, in which Pamela Evatt got president's endorsement. And then the president decided to endorse two people in the race. So he endorsed, you know, Alan Wilson. So the president doesn't mind endorsing two candidates in a race. So the fact that we are now onto a second race and then a runoff, and the president refuses to endorse Ralph Norman, no matter what. I think it all goes back to the fact that he decided that he was going to throw his support behind Nikki Haley 2 years ago when she made her fledgling, but early presidential run against the president.
So one can deduce that in South Carolina, not having the president's endorsement will not get you the race. You will not win without that endorsement. One can deduce that. It may not be true. But despite all of this, Ralph Norman sounds optimistic about his chances.
I may not have been the first choice. I may not have been the second choice. I want to be the third and the fourth choice of everybody. I want everybody to unite and come with us.
Ben?
Okay, so that sounds crazy, and rarely do you have a politician like so honestly say, I don't need to be your first choice. I'll be your second choice, third, or fourth. But realistically, that's actually a strategy because at this point, you are in a runoff. And so 40% of people on Tuesday did not vote for him or Darlene Graham. So that's a lot of votes up for grabs. So honestly, if he is someone's second or third choice and that's how they vote, he could very well win in 2 weeks.
So we're heading toward ranked choice voting in South Carolina here. That's what's happening. Okay. CMPD would like to apply for a federal Make America Safe Again grant, a MASA grant. But the Charlotte City Council isn't so sure that that is a good idea. First, Alex, what is a Make America Safe Again grant?
This is a grant that the DOJ is giving out to only 2 to 4 cities. They have up to $300 million from the Big Beautiful Bill. And this could go to a lot of different things. It could go to mental health services. It could go to the sheriff's office. It could go to drones for the police department. So one thing important to note, though, is that this is a cooperative grant, which means that the DOJ would have a lot of say over how Charlotte is spending this money, and that was a point of contention for city council, especially given the current administration.
Yeah, you report in Axios that Charlotte has drawn national scrutiny following several high-profile crimes, including a recent attack in Dilworth, but Charlotte City Council's Victoria Watlington says that applying for this grant, quote, seems like we are opening Pandora's box, and she's not alone in her misgivings about this. Is it the strings attached and what and the unknown strings attached that some members of council are worried about?
Yeah, I think there's multiple levels here. I think there's a lot of distrust, especially after Operation Charlotte's Web, which was that immigration crackdown we had in November. The city council did not like how they came into the city. There's also a clause in the application that states something along the lines of Charlotte would have to pay the government back if the city experienced a surge in violence and they had to deploy federal forces here. It's unknown what that cost would be or what a surge in violence could mean to this clause. So that was concerning. And then I also just think because of the technology this money could fund, there are questions about federal surveillance into the city. But overall, just a lot of distrust between this Democratic majority council and Donald Trump.
Yeah, because Donald Trump could be the one that brings federal troops to town that we would then have to pay back. It would not necessarily be our asking them to come. He could just dispatch them and suddenly we'd be on the hook. Eric?
Yeah, I think what Alex is saying is very accurate. You know, Malcolm Graham, among other council members, made a comment to Chief Patterson to the effect of, this really isn't about you. It's about the federal government, and we don't trust the federal government. If it was another administration, a grant like this would be welcome, but we simply can't trust them. Renee Johnson made a comment to the effect of, when people show you who they are, believe them. And some council members, by the end of the conversation, were asking the city manager to essentially just stop researching this because there's no way that they would ever accept it. It sounds like they are going to try to find answers to the 80 questions that were posed to the chief, but the deadline is September 1st to apply for this grant. So it seems pretty unlikely that this is going to happen.
And does city council have the final say on whether or not we apply?
They need a lot of signatures just to submit the grant application. So I don't think that this is happening. I think the response is pretty strong. I'd be surprised if they even put that much time or effort into answering those questions.
So CMPD was in front of council talking about that this week. They were also talking about a possible change to teen curfew regulations. This comes in the wake of a series of recent teen takeovers in various parts of town. Eric, what are they considering?
Well, the basic thing they're considering is going from a two-tiered system that right now is for children 12 and under and those 13, 14, and 15 that have different time ranges. The chief wants to go to a 17 and under 9 p.m. curfew for everyone. She says that that's much easier to enforce and for everyone to understand. There are exceptions for school events, religious events, jobs, running an errand for your parents, but it quickly devolved into a number of scenarios and whether those would cause teens to be punished. There was a lot of clarification from the chief that this is not creating a prison pipeline for minority students. So there is a good deal of skepticism about this.
Yeah, the current teen curfew is children 12 and younger have to be home by 10, those 13 to 15 by 11. And she says it's too difficult to enforce that because a lot of kids don't have IDs. CMPD Chief Estella Patterson also says it's too lenient and that her officers are struggling to contain these teen takeovers. But she also assured counsel, as you pointed out, that her sole motivation in all of this is not something more concerning.
Mayor and council, please hear me clearly when I say that we are not proposing to criminalize our youth. We don't want to criminalize them for being teenagers. We will not be instituting a curfew police. I don't have the staffing for it, so we will never do that. We are not creating a prison pipeline for youth of color.
Is that a common concern among council members and or their constituents?
Yes, that is very much a concern. There are already so many circumstances in the criminal justice system that are viewed as inherently unfair, filled with systemic racism. And so any talk like this instantly stirs those up. Mike, the other thing I want to mention really quickly is while the chief was treated graciously and respectfully by counsel, you know, she has been very, very popular since she took this job. This really was the first instance of any kind of pushback on something she has suggested. And it was with two items that came on the same night. Obviously, we just talked about the Make America Safe Again grant. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting wrinkle subplot to this as well.
People are resistant to change. As the deadline nears for members of CARTPO, the Charlotte Area Regional Transportation Planning Organization, lovely name, to decide whether or not to reverse their rejection of the I-77 toll lanes, the town of Matthews is urging members to stand pat, Alex. NCDOT is holding out at the moment both a carrot and a stick. What are they?
Yeah, our options here are for the local government to either pay back potentially $80 million to the state for the work done on 77 or just let it move forward. And what the Matthews town attorney is saying is that we shouldn't, Charlotte as a region shouldn't consent to being treated this way. There's a debate now emerging about how much the state should have a say in this. This was a vote that the Charlotte region lawfully took to cancel this transportation project. And this could be setting some kind of precedent where they no longer have the power to do so.
That Matthews town attorney is Daniel Peterson. And on Monday, he said he wants CARTPO members to remain resolved in their opposition to what he sees essentially as bullying.
Again, Matthews nor any other local government seek this conflict, but cannot stand by and tacitly consent to be treated this way. Whether one agrees with the I-77 toll lanes project as proposed or not, this style of legislation should have no place in our state or our country, and I call on cooler heads to prevail at the state level than have thus far.
There already are questions about the legality of the threats to those who have this no vote on the toll lanes, the legality of forcing them to pay back the money, and the legality of some of the other things that we've heard. I don't know that they're true, that we would, other road projects and other infrastructure projects we would lose funding for or be put at the back of the line for. What have we heard from other members, Eric, of CARTPO, as we approach this September meeting where they're going to vote on this? What have we heard from the member that has the most at stake because we have the most votes and therefore we know the most money, and that would be Charlotte?
Yeah, so a couple things there, Mike. One is we've had several of the smaller towns reverse course and say that they will no longer oppose this, and one can only assume that is for fear of having to pay the money, because that money is much bigger when you have a much smaller budget, as those small mm-hmm. towns do. So that's basic math. You're right. Charlotte city government is the big one. They control 42% of the vote total, and council has had several debates and discussions about where this goes next. They really have not made any progress. There has been much discussion continuing about studying alternatives, but of course that can't happen anywhere near fast enough to meet the deadline of late next month. So I think the next steps are that council will at least discuss this again within the next couple of weeks, and then they're likely going to have to take another vote to direct Ed Driggs, the representative, on what he will do at that September 23rd CARTPO meeting, where they will vote again on whether this rescission stands up.
Meanwhile, oh, I'm sorry, Ben, go ahead.
I was just saying, I talked to Ed Driggs about this a few days ago, and the way he described it is that basically this will probably more than likely come down specifically to Charlotte. What they say will probably end up going, because they have such a large sort of vote on CRTPO. But not only that, he was saying that he thinks, without naming any names, he said it's going to come down to one or two people on council, that there's probably three people on council that are not going to change their minds no matter what you do, no matter what you say, that there's one, maybe two, that might switch their votes. So basically, you're talking about this huge issue, millions and millions of dollars, all these cities, all this money, all these commuters, and it's honestly going to probably come down to like one or two people.
So I mentioned that NCDOT presented both a carrot and a stick, and Alex a minute ago talked about the stick, and that is what we've been talking about, this $60 million payback, among other things. But there's also a carrot involved in all of this. Eric, in your report, that the state's leading retail association opposes the use of I-77 toll lane funding to be used for grocery stores in these underserved areas. That is what NCDOT is suggesting, $300 million to locate two grocery stores in what are essentially grocery store deserts on the west side. Why is the Retail Association opposed? And I have 30 seconds.
Because they say that's an unfair advantage for those retailers as compared to others who don't receive public funding.
Okay. It sounds like New York City and Mondami, but we'll come back to that in a moment, because the Retail Association says, no, leave it up to us. We'll get you grocery stores, but they never have. So we'll come back and talk about that in a moment with the members of our panel here, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV, and James Farrell, education reporter at WFAE News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. So we've been talking about the Retail Association opposing the use of I-77 toll lane funds to put grocery stores in on the west side as kind of a carrot for saying yes to the I-77 toll lanes. These stores are proposed for areas, as we have said, that have been long needed convenient access to grocery stores, but have never been able to get them to be located there, a decision always ascribed to market forces. Retailers don't believe they could be profitable in those areas. And yet, the Retail Association says, quote, the proposal to fund two grocery stores would set a dangerous precedent. And in their statement, they go on to say that they respectfully request that NCDOT and private developers continue to trust in local business owners to develop and operate stores that benefit the communities they know firsthand. Eric, these are food deserts. They've been trying to get these grocery stores for years. Is trust warranted in this case?
Well, let's put it this way. It's been 36 years since this area of Charlotte has had a full-service supermarket. So I think it's pretty clear that market forces are not taking care of this. But Mike, there's so much at play here just in this little story that we're talking about with I-77, NCDOT, the developers and the retailers. I wanted to go back and clarify for just a second. The $300 million that you referenced was mentioned in a letter from the transportation secretary 2 weeks ago. Those are all the ancillary benefits of building this road that could include sidewalks and connectors, interchanges, and those kinds of things, and some money for those two co-op food markets were part of that. They have not mentioned a specific amount. The other thing to remember, Mike, is that NCDOT says that the Retail Merchants Association has mischaracterized the, I guess, the process that will play out with this, and that they will have a fuller answer. I have not received that fuller answer. That was at the beginning of the week. So there's a lot going on here.
And to be fair, the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association claims that these proposed locations for these two grocery stores are, quote, already served by multiple grocery retailers, including at least five stores within an approximately 3 to 10 minute drive, offering both full service supermarket and discount grocery options. But we keep hearing from people in those neighborhoods that these options don't exist. Is the disconnect over the fact that the Retail Merchants Association maybe doesn't understand that a lot of these people can't make that 3 to 5 minute car a drive because they don't have cars?
Yes. I mean, isn't it ironic that a transportation issue is coming down to transportation? They don't have cars. Maybe the transit takes too long or isn't effective. So we've got the entirety of this problem summed up in one little fight over whether there's funding for two grocery stores.
Alex.
I also think it's not just the Retail Merchant Association. It's going to be a lot of people who take issue with NCDOT saying, here's $300 million in return for you supporting our project, because then you're looking at the rest of the state. All the other cities are going to say, well, what do we get if you come into our community and you want to do this thing or you want to change this interchange? Do we also get sidewalks and grocery stores and whatnot? So I think NCDOT may be a little surprised at the pushback that they get from that from other people in North Carolina.
It's a mess, in short. More to come. 3 years, three principals. It was announced this week, James, that Ardrey Carroll High School's principal of 1 year, Susan Willis, will retire on November the 1st, which means there will be another new principal there sometime this fall. Why?
Yeah, so this appears to be mostly a family-related situation. Principal Susan Willis put out a message to families saying that she's planning to move to England to be with her husband. They've been in a long-distance relationship for a couple of years, and she said it was time to start her life with him. You know, she thanked the school district and thanked the school community, said that her time was really meaningful, but it seems to be related to her wanting to be with her husband over in England.
Yeah, they've been doing this transatlantic commute for 3 years. Didn't the district know this last year when they made her the principal? Wasn't this a concern of hers a year ago?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that one. I do know that obviously part of what adds to the sense of volatility here is what happened with Principal Jamie Brooks last year. Right. She was suspended and then ultimately retired in circumstances that were not disclosed. I'm sure that in the backdrop of what's been going on with the superintendent as well, there's sort of these broader questions about volatility and change. It looks like in this specific case, this was a family-oriented thing, not related to like a controversy or something like that. But given kind of the cloud that's hanging over from the previous principal change, I'm sure that there's a sense of kind of instability there as well.
How disruptive is a principal change to a high school? Is it that big a deal?
Yeah, well, it can often change sort of like the strategies that are guiding the school and the communication. I think not having a leader in the moment, it depends on how well the transition goes. And she's talked about working with the assistant superintendent there assistant principal there to try to create a smooth transition. And there is a little bit of a runway here up until November 1st when she leaves. So hopefully that would ease any transition that they make. But obviously, when you have three different leaders in such a short period of time, that is going to create some instability. It is going to create some questions about leadership dynamics, things like that, that have to get adjusted. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
So staying with schools for a moment, there's a group of CMS parents that are making a push for some specific policy changes aimed at limiting technology, hopefully in advance of the start of the school year. This is not just local. This is happening all over the country, as a matter of fact, with parents saying, enough with the screens. What are these parents asking for?
Yeah, and to your point first, you know, this group, this Schools Beyond Screens, is actually a chapter of a larger group that started in Los Angeles, which, if you've seen any of the reporting recently, this year is implementing a lot of strict screen time limitations for kids. This group of parents here in Charlotte, they want kind of a broader look at technology use in schools in general, but they're starting with these kind of what they call the Essential Six policy proposals that they're hoping CMS can implement before the start of this new school year. That includes things like banning school devices completely for kids in pre-K through second grade, with some exceptions for state testing and accommodations and things like that. No tech during indoor recess. They want a bell-to-bell cell phone ban. And they're also hoping that CMS just takes kind of an overall review of how technology is used across the district. That's basically it.
Sherry Bissell is the president of the Collinswood Language Academy PTA and the leader of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg chapter of Schools Beyond Screens.
We don't want to be confused with not wanting any technology. It just needs to be implemented in such a way that it clearly proves that students are learning.
Why are screens suddenly taboo if they're being used for educational purposes and not just to doom scroll?
Mike, I think it's so interesting watching how this has played out over the last several years, because obviously you had the pandemic. There was a rush to get technology into kids' hands. There was sort of the talk about technology being a great equalizer. And then at the same time, you see all these studies that come out about the mental health downsides of too much screen time, especially for young children. So I think those two tensions are at play here. I think that parents are seeing the kind of things that kids are doing on their computers. We know, obviously, in the past few months, there's been conversation about that program iReady that CMS parents have been pushing back against. You know, that's something that parents and students are seeing, and they're feeling like it's not the kind of educational experience that they want. So it's just kind of interesting seeing this kind of groundswell against this come up. It's sort of like a correction to the COVID era, where the goal was to get technology in front of every kid. This seems to be a correction to that in sort of the opposite direction.
What has been the response of the district so far?
CMS has so far been seemingly open to some of this. At the school board meeting this week, actually, they talked about making some of these adjustments. They have kind of committed to looking at how their technology use it plays out across the district over the course of this next school year to see what kind of adjustments can be made that are evidence-based. They talked about this year trying to at least limit how often kids in grades K through 2 are using devices. They've also talked about blocking YouTube for those kids. That was one of the other six proposals, is making sure kids don't have independent access to YouTube on their devices. So CMS has said they would do that for kids in grades K through 2. So there's definitely a dialogue happening here, and it'll be interesting to watch this play out over the course of this year as CMS looks at its screen time use, its device usage, and maybe creates new policy proposals and how parents feel about those.
Last week, Eric, we reported on a vociferous pushback from citizens to a proposed Islamic center already under construction there. Several people got pretty angry and a little ugly during a Mooresville town meeting. And this week, a dozen Charlotte area Muslims gathered in uptown Charlotte to support this planned center. Why did they hold their press conference in Charlotte as opposed to Mooresville?
Yeah, that's a good question. I never heard the answer. I can only assume that they believe they would be able to attract more media in uptown Charlotte because it's closer than trekking out to Davidson. But as you say, about a dozen people, and they simply conveyed the message that this should not be a controversial topic. This is a peaceful project, and just really ask people to be open-minded about it.
Hadia Mubarak is a professor of religion at Queen's University of Charlotte, and she says she wants residents to know that Muslims are their neighbors, and she wants them to be seen as members of the same community.
As a Muslim American, I have one message for my neighbors in Charlotte, Mooresville, and the surrounding communities. Our religion teaches us that faith in God means loving you as we would love ourselves.
So Mooresville is becoming the epicenter of Charlotte news of late. In April, the town board delivered a vote of no confidence in Mayor Chris Carney after it discovered that security cameras caught him not wearing pants inside Mooresville Town Hall late at night. It led to lawsuits filed by whistleblowers. And now Mooresville Commissioner Dana Tuck wants the board to address a no-confidence vote that they took in April. Why now, after so many months?
I think the sentiment is simply, it's been 4 months. We've done nothing. We have to act on this. This was not just a throwaway sentiment. We need to act on this. And by the way, the Mooresville Board of Commissioners meets next on this Monday, August the 17th. So there actually might be a number of Charlotte media members trekking up to Davidson.
Yeah. Well, after that no confidence in the mayor vote was taken in April, Mayor Carney refused to resign. He defended his performance as mayor. He said that the no confidence vote carried no legal force. First of all, is that true?
I don't believe there is legal force behind it, no.
And he also claimed that all of this is politically driven. Is there any evidence to support that?
I mean, Mike, is anything not politically driven? I would have a difficult time saying a political body is acting in any way other than politically.
Okay. Meanwhile, I couldn't find the right analogy here, but meanwhile, Mooresville has more fish to fry. It was recently revealed, Ben, that their police department had joined others around the country. I couldn't find a bird analogy, but they've joined other police forces around the country, including CMPD, where officers have misused the flock system of license plate cameras. So remind us how these cameras were misused.
Yeah, so this is juicy in that you've got this great crime-fighting tool that's being used all across the country by these different departments that can help you crack crimes and find suspects. It's a license plate reader that you can put alongside the road and you catch people. It can identify cars, even their bumper stickers. It's this great technology that can do great things for these police departments. The downside is some officers across the country are using it to spy on people like their exes. So it's problematic.
Which was kind of the case in Mooresville. I think a female police officer.
I think it was the boyfriend's ex or something like that.
That's exactly right. So they've announced in Mooresville policy changes governing these cameras. What are they doing?
So they're adding more safeguards on exactly who can access the system and keeping an accounting of who can access that system. And it all happens actually while Flock, the company itself, has come out in the last 24 hours and they're announcing a new set of safeguards they're rolling out as well for all police departments. Same sort of thing, a system that will audit abnormal search behavior. Users also have to input an actual case number for every single search they do. So we say Mooresville, CMPD has had this issue, a completely unrelated case, but police departments all across the country. And now it seems like Flock, the maker of these license plate readers, is trying to get ahead of it.
Mike, is it a stretch to say that Mooresville's trying to get its ducks in a row? Do those count as birds? I don't know.
You said it. I didn't. The death last December of 6-year-old Dominique Moody resulted in the passage of the Dominique Moody Safety Law. It sparked changes in how social services operate around the state. And now her guardian, Tawnie McKnight, one of three women facing murder charges in her death, could face the death penalty. For those who don't remember, what were the circumstances of her death, Ben?
It was just god-awful. I mean, just god-awful. She was weighing, I think, 27 pounds at the time.
Right.
Multiple injuries, burns, broken ribs.
Starvation.
I think she'd been kept in a dog crate for a while. It just one of the worst cases we've reported on in recent years.
How unusual is it for a Mecklenburg prosecutor to seek the death penalty?
Very. Last time they started down this road was almost 10 years ago in 2017. They ended up changing course at that point. It is not something that local prosecutors often do or take lightly. I believe this would be Spencer Merriweather's very first death penalty case.
So finally, the new Metropolitan Public Transit Association, not to be confused with CARTPO, voted this week to add...
I still don't understand.
That's right, to add Camp North End as a stop on the Red Line commuter train and to conduct a feasibility study on another potential stop along West Craighead Road in North Charlotte, where residents have felt for a while neglected and they feel that this could help.
What we're seeing right now is that they're not giving us an opportunity to show and prove that we're capable, because we're the inner city, we're capable of doing some of the same things that they're bringing from other surrounding areas.
So that's Charlene Henderson, who works with the Hidden Valley Community Association. WCNC-TV reports that several trustees and CATS staff warned that adding a station there at this stage could jeopardize the project's Federal Transit Administration funding or scoring. I have about 20 seconds left. Why, Ben?
Because honestly, the problem is it's not just West Craighead. It's any additional stop. You start adding more stops, you start slowing down service. And then all of a sudden it goes from 30 minutes to get to Uptown to 45.
Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Business Journal, and James Farrell from WFAE News. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.